GovX Data Points, where we talk all things government and data. I'm your host, Eric Reese, this week bringing you a special episode from guest producer Amy Hutchinson, focusing on how data was used to combat a public health crisis in one U.S. city. Since the 1980s, HIV and AIDS have posed a serious threat to the lives and well-being of people around the world, especially those who live in cities. Here in the U.S., the District of Columbia had a particularly difficult time fighting the epidemic among residents, and in 2007, it was estimated that 1 in 20 district residents were HIV positive. Other major cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Detroit, and Chicago were also epicenters of the disease, but their prevalence rates were half or even just a quarter of DC's. Today's episode highlights how, after declaring HIV/AIDS the mayor's number one public health priority, the District of Columbia turned their epidemic around by using data to reduce HIV transmissions by 70% in 7 years. It's a story full of lessons on how important data is in tackling major public health problems that threaten the lives and well-being of people in our communities. As cities continue to combat HIV and confront new threats like the Zika virus, using data to understand epidemics as they evolve is key to controlling them. Now to bring you the story, we turn it over to producer Amy Hutchinson.
In 2007, when Adrian Fenney was elected mayor of Washington, D.C., he declared HIV and AIDS his number one public health priority. At the time, some estimated that 1 in 20 of the district's residents were HIV positive. Other major cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Detroit, and Chicago were also epicenters of the disease, but their prevalence rates were half or even just a quarter of DC's. Worse still, if you looked at new pediatric cases across the entire nation, 9% of them came from right here in the capital. This is in a city that's only 9 by 11 miles and home to just 0.2% of the U.S. population. The city's failure to control the epidemic wasn't for lack of effort. Between 2000 and 2006, hundreds of millions of dollars went to outreach, counseling, care, housing, and prevention programs, but the prevalence rate still climbed 20% in the next 2 years. By 2009, ads started popping up on bus shelters all over the city calling HIV and AIDS DC's Hurricane Katrina. Fortunately, this was also the year the prevalence rate started to fall, and it's continued to do so ever since. In this episode of Data Points, I'm going to tell you how DC turned around the Titanic in the middle of the Potomac, reducing new transmissions by 70% in 7 years. It's a story rife with lessons on how important data is in tackling major public health problems.
The year before, in 2005, the DC Appleseed Center and the Washington AIDS Partnership had conducted an analysis of how well the district was responding to HIV. And the result of that examination was that the district had a fairly poor response to the epidemic.
That was Michael Carfin.
And I am the Senior Deputy Director for the HIV/AIDS, Hepatitis, STD, and TB Administration in the DC Department of Health.
When it comes to the DC government's efforts to address HIV and AIDS over the last 10 years, Michael is the proverbial fountain of knowledge. He started working at the DC Department of Health in 2006. Which is right around the time the DOH started drawing a lot of heat.
The district hadn't released any new statistics on HIV in about 5 years. So the whole notion of being able to respond to an epidemic based on surveillance and epidemiology was not present at all. So it looked like the district's response was in a state of disarray. In addition to the data portions, there were questions about some of the funding to community-based organizations and medical providers. They were complaining about not getting payments in a timely way that was impacting the effective delivery of services. So there was definitely challenges in the district's ability to respond to the epidemic.
Tony Young agreed.
One of the things I would say is that it was chaotic. You know, I don't think you want to go to an international conference and the Washington Post has a headline that says 3% of your population is living with HIV And the World Health Organization says 1% is really bad, you know?
Tony's the founder and executive director of an organization called the Community Education Group, or CEG.
Community Education Group primarily focuses on HIV, hepatitis C testing, and linkage to care activities. Our primary goal is to do those things through condom distribution, increased access to community by doing outreach events, testing events for both hepatitis C and HIV.
Tony is exactly the kind of person you hope is working in DC communities. She's incredibly affable, she's energetic, she's entrepreneurial, and she's totally committed.
I actually have been working on HIV prevention in the district probably for more than 30 years. In 91, my best friend at the time contracted HIV. And that was how I ended up starting an organization and working in HIV on a regular basis. I'm African-American, born and raised in D.C., Ward 7, which is east of the Anacostia River in D.C., primarily African-American. Ward 7, I believe, is still 98% African-American. But my friend, he was from a small town in Texas. It's called Burkbeneck, Texas. We had met while he was doing a internship here. And when he contracted HIV, he said to me, you know, what if this was you? And I was like, what do you mean? He said, instead of being him, who's white, gay, from Texas, and wealthy, he said, what if, you know, it was female, black, and not having as much access? So he said to me, you should always work in your response to this disease for people of color and women, because people like me will always find a way. It'll be people like you who won't necessarily have the same opportunity. And shortly thereafter, I started what was then the National Women in HIV AIDS Project, and we later became Community Education Group.
So Toni was on the front lines of this fight. And like Michael, she definitely felt like the city didn't have the firmest grip on exactly what it was dealing with.
What it was looking like was confusing, because the numbers weren't matching up with what we were seeing. You know, it's kind of how, it was kind of like how you might go to an event, you go to a large event and they say, well, there were 1,000 people on the mall. And you're like, I was there and it seemed like there was 50,000 people. And it was kind of that, like, who's counting and how are they counting? We didn't have a system in place that was consistent with how other jurisdictions across the United States were calculating the same thing. And so that impacted on the ground how resources were allocated. For us, organizationally, for Community Education Group, what it meant was scale, right? So one of the things that we had to figure out strategically was how were we gonna scale up testing, even though we thought, we were being told that there was this kind of flat rate of incidence. It's like, that can't be true. We've scaled up testing. We have higher numbers. We have higher numbers of reactive tests, meaning people that are testing positive for HIV. So something's not right. We'll continue that scale. But again, the resource is not necessarily going to match up with that, because it's like, well, those people don't exist. So if they don't exist, but I have them, and then I go to try to get them new services, those services don't exist because nobody's built the infrastructure for them to go to, because there's not necessarily a need, or there's not a documentable need.
And it wasn't just Tony. No one really trusted the city's data on AIDS. People leading the effort were saying things like, we have some data, but we don't really know what it means. That's an actual quote. In fact, in 2006, the Washington Post broke a story about how the new director of HIV and AIDS surveillance stumbled across 5 boxes of case files in an abandoned office. They were records on 2,000 to 3,000 cases in the district, more than a year old, that weren't even in the city's database yet. This didn't account for all of the gaps in the city's data set, but it was kind of the perfect metaphor for what was happening more broadly.
There was
not some core work not getting done. There were core case, there were cases not being included in our data system. So we didn't have an accurate number of HIV cases in the District of Columbia. Starting as that a starting off point is really hard to figure out how you deploy your resources and strategies when you don't even know who's got HIV.
All of this seems mind-blowingly obvious, right? I mean, how could the city have had such a startling lack of information on a major public health crisis and not think that was crippling prevention efforts? One wonders how it even got to this point. And there are really quite a few reasons, and they range from very technical data acquisition and management issues to some of the more pattern criticisms you might hear of any city government that isn't exactly nailing it on a particular issue. Some specifics will come into sharper focus in just a minute, but Tony gave a pretty good postmortem.
Marion Barry and Effie Barry started one of the first HIV/AIDS offices that was funded by a district, by a local government. And I think it was actually the first. Now, this was done with no knowing. And the office was funded. Actions were put into place, systems were put into place, again, at the beginning of an epidemic when no one knew anything. This system was created quickly. It was created with not all of the pieces in place, and it was doing the very, very best job it could to respond to a crisis, and it never left crisis mode.
Notice how she said respond, not assess or analyze.
So by the time we got to 2003, it was like, oh my God, like everybody's using these things, surveillance data, science data, metrics, this, that, and the other. And we've been trying to keep people living with HIV in care and treatment, giving them services, and we've been trying to prevent HIV. That's what we've been trying to do.
Basically, the city was fighting the epidemic in crisis mode for two decades, so no one really took the time to go back and evaluate the initial battle plan or build the infrastructure to measure their success. By 2006, a major rethink was way overdue. Fortunately, the next 2 to 3 years brought a lot of changes. New allies, new leadership, new information, and new approaches, which, a decade later, have proven enormously consequential. One of the first and most significant shifts involved bringing some sorely needed skill sets to the table.
I would say that one of the efforts towards progress that was a significant one was an establishment of a partnership between the Department of Health and the George Washington University School of Public Health. A large part of that is a credit to Alan Greenberg, and that enabled the district to be able to bring in some resources, bring in capacity to do surveillance work and epidemiology. Epidemiology work. And in fact, at the time in 2006, there wasn't even a full-time epidemiologist on the staff at the Department of Health.
Tony also sang Dr. Greenberg's praises. He's the chair of the Epidemiology and Biostatistics Department at George Washington University. Before that, he did HIV and AIDS surveillance at the CDC. And shortly after this partnership was forged, the DOH hired an epidemiologist by the name of Tiffany West to be the chief of its surveillance division.
It was a great confluence of beginning to change the paradigm with respect to how the district was collecting information and analyzing that information.
DC doubled down on surveillance and epidemiology in 2007 by hiring Shannon Hader to lead the HIV and AIDS administration.
The smartest thing that we ever did as a city was to hire Shannon Hader. She's probably one of the smartest people I know on the face of the planet, and I know a lot of smart people. And she was the right thing for the city at the right time.
Shannon was actually the fourth person to hold this position in less than 3 years, but she was a real departure from everyone who sat in that chair before her. They were public administrators, and she was an MD. They may have been veterans in navigating the bureaucracies of city governance and federal funding, but she was a veteran HIV and AIDS epidemiologist who had been the director of the CDC in Zimbabwe.
We needed someone that wasn't about the politics of it, but was about the getting it done.
So, with Shannon, Tiffany, and this new GW partnership, the city was starting to build a mature surveillance system that would allow for more sophisticated epidemiological work. But that would ultimately take about 5 years. More immediately, DC still had to get its core surveillance activities in order, which is basically just identifying cases and documenting them all in one place, just to get a current snapshot of the epidemic and baseline data it could trust. Now, part of this just came down to running a tighter ship, but nationwide trends also helped usher DC in the right direction. For example, around this time, risk-based screening fell from favor. Doctors used to decide whether to test a patient based on their potential exposure. And that's a sensible strategy, but only if you already know all of the high-risk demographics in your city. If you don't, you're probably just confirming there's AIDS where you think it is and failing to spot emerging at-risk populations. In 2006, the CDC started recommending routine voluntary testing in healthcare settings for everyone between 13 and 64. DC's data showed that doctors had in fact been missing cases, so the DOH basically started telling them test everyone who walks through the door unless they specifically opt out. The shift also coincided with the advent of rapid oral testing, which offered preliminary results in just 20 minutes.
It was also a non-invasive test, so you didn't have to draw blood in order to do it. And the district took advantage of that in expanding HIV testing efforts in clinical settings, in community settings, in outreach settings.
So naturally, the city started capturing more cases. But there was also a shift in case reporting specifically on HIV that made a huge difference. To give you a little background, AIDS had been a reportable disease since 1983, meaning providers and laboratories were legally forced to report cases of full-blown AIDS to the Department of Health. But HIV only became reportable in 2001. At that point, the DC DOH started tracking HIV diagnoses using a code-based system to protect the patient's identity. AIDS, on the other hand, was tracked using a names-based system. Now, that might just seem like a small difference, but really it meant you couldn't consolidate the two data sets and no one knew how much overlap there was. So there was really no reliable data on just HIV and DC, which many argued was even more important than AIDS data. As Washington Post reporter Jose Antonio Vargas put it, to understand what was happening with the epidemic a decade ago, look at the current AIDS data. To understand what's happening right now and what'll happen in the future, look at the HIV data. Fortunately, in 2007, DC switched to names-based reporting of HIV.
There's a whole history of the fact of HIV and AIDS reporting that has always raised red flags for community. But we were able to transition. It also helped that CDC basically said, you have to do this or we're going to basically cut off funding for you. So we had some impetus as well.
All of these staffing and operational changes would bear fruit in November of 2007. That's when Mayor Feeney released the city's first statistical report on DC's HIV and AIDS epidemic in 5 years. It included the first HIV statistics ever published in the district. The significance of this report can't be overstated. It simultaneously exemplified and enabled a major pivot toward a more data-driven approach.
We even made it with the spiral-bound binder to it so that people could just use this as it was a practical document. Our intention was that this was not something to stick on the shelf.
And while it represented a major step forward for the city, what it revealed was pretty terrible. The report actually prompted banner headlines about how the HIV rate in the U.S. capital was on par with several countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So let's just say it didn't do much for the city's reputation, but it was a serious wake-up call to D.C. residents and exactly what people working on the issue had been begging for.
When we released the first report stating that we believed that we were at a 3% threshold, meaning that 3% of the district population was living with HIV. I would say validated is the word that I felt. But then the next feeling was challenged. Because if you have a population where you have 3% of the epidemic, 3% of the population living with HIV, the next level of question is, now what do we do? Because the resources aren't going to follow that as quickly as you need them to. The other part of that is if we're saying it's 3%, what have we missed along the way, and how do we ensure that those folks have access?
So the city was prepared to adjust its course based on the report's findings, and it would have to. The report actually painted a much different picture of the epidemic than had been assumed, both based on other cities and the history of the local epidemic.
There was not only an epidemic of significance in terms of size, but, and this point being particularly relevant, was that it was a diverse epidemic. We characterized it then as a modern epidemic. That was Dr. Hayter's term for it, because unlike most of the country where there was one or two major modes of transmission, and the three modes being heterosexual contact, men who have sex with men, and injection drug use, those three modes of transmission were at high rates in the district. So unlike even New York and San Francisco, where it was one or two, we had all three at significant proportions. And that made it much more complex and diverse.
So to break it down, let's say you have 1,000 D.C. residents. The report said that 30 of them would be HIV positive, and of those 30, 10 were men who have sex with men, 9 were heterosexual, and 6 were injection drug users. Now, most of the new cases were in the heterosexual category, which was a big surprise to everyone. And really what it meant was that now you're looking at a much larger segment of the population than gay men and injection drug users represent, which is also probably part of the reason that risk-based screening had been insufficient.
So to say that heterosexuals were now at risk in the district took a major culture shift for a lot of people. I would go out to community meetings and talk about our surveillance results, talk about some of the studies we had done. And people would say to me, that's not true, that you're making that up, or I don't believe you.
Now, this was a pretty dangerous misconception, especially for women. You had a huge swath of the population that hadn't really considered itself at risk or been prioritized in the city's prevention efforts. And that's exactly where the HIV rates and consequently the probability of exposure was climbing. This was especially true among women in African American communities. The report showed that 80% of people living with HIV and AIDS in the district were African American, compared to 48% nationally. 90% of the newly infected women in D.C. were African American. It was one of the fastest growing demographics among those living with HIV in D.C. Now, if you've lived in D.C. for the last 10 years and have been paying attention to HIV and AIDS at all, this might be old news. But it was a huge eye-opener at the time and would require major investments in re-educating people about who's at risk.
It led us to develop new programs around reaching women directly through working with community-based organizations, particularly also working in the faith community. And now it is pretty much and also informing our rolling out of PrEP among women. And that's another effort that has not been in much of the discussion at all. And so to us, though, it's clearly evident when 1 out of 5 of our new HIV cases are among women, African-American, heterosexual women, we need some new tools. And so PrEP offers that opportunity.
This new demographic data also raised real concerns about treatment access, which you've heard Tony mention several times because it was especially true among CEG's target communities. Remember, Tony works primarily with heterosexual African Americans in Anacostia. If you're not familiar with DC, Anacostia is a prime example of how racial segregation and concentrated poverty are deeply intertwined problems. A topic for a whole other podcast, but I mention it now because it had very real implications for access to quality healthcare in many of the African American neighborhoods with high prevalence rates. Now, you can work in testing where healthcare settings are limited, and the city did. Through various partnerships, DC started testing at the DMV, public benefits offices, substance abuse centers, prisons, and STD clinics, but you still had the problem of getting people with a positive diagnosis into treatment. And that wasn't just affecting the health of those with HIV, it was undermining efforts to prevent the spread of the disease. To understand how treatment access relates to prevention, you need to know about something called the treatment cascade.
even though it's credited to a man named Gardner, who's not here in D.C., he recognizes it was the work of the D.C. folks to understand this notion of what was then called the treatment cascade: diagnosis, linkage into care, retention in care, and achieving viral load suppression.
Here's some background. Advances in AIDS medication made it possible to reduce the amount of HIV in someone's blood so much that they were highly unlikely to spread it to anyone else. That's called achieving viral load suppression. So the DC DOH started really zeroing in on this idea that diagnosing HIV-positive people and getting them into treatment might be just as important in stopping the spread of the disease as it was to keeping them alive and healthy. Now, through this lens, the DOH is looking at data from 1997 to 2006 and seeing that 70% of all HIV cases were among people who had the disease a long time before they were diagnosed. In fact, DC's rate of late testers was nearly twice as high as it was across the U.S.
Also, one of the key understandings was that most of new infections of HIV were attributable to people who had it and didn't know it. The data was in effect telling us if we weren't diagnosing people, then we were creating more HIV.
So dialing up testing had been a crucial first step. But new data was starting to show that 50% of people who tested positive went at least another year before getting into treatment.
I'll never forget it. I was so proud. I was so proud of the moment that we got to testing 10,000 people annually. And nobody else was doing that. Now, I don't care how big you were, how small you were. We had tested 10,000 people. And I remember Shannon called me into the health department and asked me for a meeting. And I was like, okay. And she sat me down. It was in this conference room. And she said, so you tested 10,000 people. And I was like, yes, this is great, given where we are. And she said, it's nothing. I said, what do you mean it's nothing? She said, I looked at every number that you have. And I said, okay. And she said, of those people that are reactive, you know, fewer than 10% of those people have made it into treatment. She said, so it's nothing. And she said, if you want to do something, it's about getting those folks into care.
DC was actually the pioneer in using the treatment cascade markers, which again are diagnosis, linkage to care, treatment adherence, and viral load suppression, as a framework for monitoring the epidemic, gauging its own response, and developing more strategic interventions.
We put in this notion protocol called red carpet entry, which was this idea that you would get, not idea, where you would get this protocol where you would get an appointment with an HIV medical provider within 72 hours of your diagnosis.
I just have to say, if I cut off my arm in a freak accident tomorrow, I'm not sure I could see a specialist in 72 hours in this city. So this was a pretty impressive initiative and required buy-in and participation from a lot of people, including Tony and CEG.
We still do it now where we will come pick you up from your house. We'll take you to your medical appointment and we'll take you home. You call us, we'll take you to your follow-up appointments, because what we also got was that it was silly stuff like, man, it's raining. I don't feel like going to the doctor today. Man, I don't want to get wet. So it was, okay, I'll come get you so you don't go get wet.
And it's made a huge difference. The DOH released its first report on the treatment cascade markers last year, and at least 80% of the people who tested positive in 2014 were in treatment within 3 months of their diagnosis. The major push now is around treatment adherence, both how to monitor it better and how to improve it across the city. The DOH is actually looking into sending mobile outreach clinicians to people who aren't getting continuous care. Now, up to this point, I've been telling you the story of how the district went from not even having an epidemiologist on staff to being named the most improved surveillance system in the country. And I don't want to diminish what kind of an impact that's had, but there's another piece of this story that's definitely worth mentioning, and that's needle exchange. Many states have needle exchange programs to prevent the spread of HIV and hepatitis among injection drug users. Congress, however, banned the DC government from funding needle exchange in the Capitol for 10 years. How and why Congress interferes with DC's budget and governance is an entirely different subject. In this case, it was really just political, but the data has shown it had some devastating impacts.
One of the more insightful depictions of what this consequence had been to the district was done by, of all people, John Oliver in his television program on HBO, because he did a segment on the fact that the district does not have voting rights, that we have taxation without representation. And so they had created a graph and wanted some updated information to confirm with us on the numbers of diagnoses of HIV attributable to injection drug use over the period of time when the ban was in place in the District of Columbia. And what they reported was over that period of time, as many as about 1,500 people got HIV from injection drug use who may not have gotten it if there had been needle exchange in the District of Columbia. And why? Because when we started needle exchange in 2008 until our latest numbers, we've seen about a 90% decrease in new HIV diagnoses attributable to injection drug use.
Wow.
90%.
Obviously, you can't really attribute this improvement to DC's epidemiological work, but it's certainly notable that the health department's local data was used on national television to show unequivocally just what a difference needle exchange programs can make. Not to mention how DC's lack of representation had deadly consequences for its residents in the fight against HIV and AIDS. In wrapping all of this up, I asked Michael if there had been one turnkey moment in the city's HIV and AIDS response in the 10 years since he's been involved. At this point, his answer shouldn't be surprising.
Well, the first turning point was being able to have data, really confident data. And you can't drive any public health response without it. It's driven all of the decision making that we've done and continues to be an area that we look as improvement.
So, what difference has all this made? Well, most notably, as of 2013, there were no babies born with HIV in the district. Overdue, but a huge step forward nonetheless. And according to a preliminary report, the number of new diagnoses in 2014 dropped nearly 30% from the year before and was almost 70% lower than it was in 2007. To put that in perspective, that's 900 people who didn't contract HIV in 2014 compared to 2007. Equally important, new data collected on care dynamics shows that nearly 90% of the cases diagnosed between 2009 and 2013 had been linked to care within a year, and 47% had reached viral load suppression, which means they're highly unlikely to spread it. All to say, DC's ability to develop data-driven solutions has led to major strides in both prevention and care. Moreover, it's saved lives. Conservatively speaking, if nothing had changed since 2007, at least 4,500 more DC residents would have contracted HIV between then and now. Moreover, the fact that pre-vaccine research will actually start here is a testament to how the city has become a real leader on an issue where it was once failing abysmally.
I used to always say that DC is not a place I wanted to live with HIV, have HIV, or needed a service for HIV. Today, that's not the case. The research outcomes, which have allowed us to, for once, be a model to other places where we, in the past, were, you know, we were the laughingstock. I mean, that literally, whether it was I went to a conference nationally or internationally, it's like, oh boy, you know, but now it's the, how did you do it?
Tony's response? No one had an ego, no one was pointing fingers, and no one did it alone. Now, if you're interested in learning more about the city's evolving response to the epidemic, DC Appleseed has tracked the district's efforts for the last 10 years through a series of annual reports. The mayor's office also releases a surveillance and epidemiology report every year. You can find those reports or use the city's data to run your own analyses, just like John Oliver, at doh.dc.gov.
Thanks again to guest producer Amy Hutchinson for bringing you this week's story. If you want to learn more about any content from this week's episode, check out the show notes and let us know if you have other questions. That's it for this week. As always, thanks for listening, and join us again next week to find out where the data points.